Hi, everybody. This is John Zaratsky, the author of Make Time and Sprint. Recently, I had the opportunity to interview Wendy Wood. Wendy is a professor of psychology and business at the University of Southern California. She's the author of a book called Good Habits, Bad Habits. And perhaps most importantly, Wendy is the world's foremost researcher on habits and how habits influence what we do every day. I was particularly interested in Wendy's work because of the way that she talks about the relationship between habits and willpower, and how she talks about the importance of designing our environments to either create or remove friction around the things that we want to do on a regular basis or stop doing. So I reached out to Wendy, and she agreed to have a chat with me. So I'm happy to bring you the recording of our conversation. There's also an edited text transcript of this conversation available on the Make Time website. So if you want to check that out, you can go to maketime.blog, click on articles, and then find the interview with Wendy. And if you'd like to learn more about Wendy's work, you can check out her book, of course. It's called Good Habits, Bad Habits. Or you can go to her website, which is goodhabitsbadhabits.org. And with that, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Wendy Wood. I almost finished reading your book, but I didn't quite make it all the way through. I was traveling a bunch this week, which is usually really good for reading, but I was also doing some events, so I didn't have as much time as I had hoped. But it's really great. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I have published a lot of research in scientific journals, but when you write a book, it's something much more personal.
Yeah.
So I appreciate good positive comments on it.
Well, you alluded to this in the intro, but there's so many books that either are directly or indirectly about habits, and so many books that get it wrong. And I worry that there are probably places in our books where I've gotten it wrong. But it's so cool to read about this, like, your research, which is really the foundational research for so much of the advice that we hear about how to form habits and how to change our behaviors.
Yeah, it's interesting. You can't really learn much about your habits just by observing them. So we all have theories about habits and how they work, because we all have habits and we've all thought about them and commented on them. But habits are not accessible to conscious awareness. Yeah. And there's good reason for that, as I try to explain in the book. But what that means then is that we really don't have the same understanding of our habits as we do of other behaviors, more thoughtful decisions we make. It's not possible to.
Yeah.
And so there are some things like that you just have to turn to research and adapt those findings.
Right. And that was one of the most interesting things about reading your book. It was that, you know, the realization that our habits are somewhat hidden from us, and that because we are paying attention to our conscious thought processes, we tend to overvalue those or assume that they're more important, or more sort of, I guess, pervasive in controlling our behaviors than they really are. And it made me wonder, you know, a lot of people that I talk to about distraction and feeling like they don't have time for the things that are important to them, they often describe this feeling of time slipping away or of time just sort of disappearing. And you know, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It's when you grab your phone to check something really quickly, and before you know it, you just spent 20 minutes scrolling through Instagram. And I wonder if that, you know, I think many people experience that, you know, driving to work. They drive to work and they get there and then they realize that they don't remember anything about the trip. And I wonder, does time slip away because when we're doing those actions, we're fully in habit mode? And so the ways that our brains are controlling our behaviors are thus hidden from us. Is that what's going on there?
Well, Those are two really interesting examples. Let's take the driving to work part. Mm-hmm. With that, I think what happens is, and this is actually one of the benefits of habit, is it's just like being in the shower. You know, you've done it so often and you know what it is you're trying to do and what the sequence is and fine. You don't have to think about it anymore. So it frees up your mind to focus on other things. We ruminate about problems we had in the past, or we plan things that are going to happen in the future. And all of that is very helpful because making sense out of past experiences and plans are super useful for all of us. And we can do things while we are planning and ruminating if we're acting on habit, but we don't have any experience of what we are doing. And that's where I think people start to feel a bit lost and confused. Mm-hmm. I've had that experience of driving somewhere and then thinking, oh my God, I didn't think about that the whole trip.
Right. And then you wonder if that was unsafe, like
exactly.
Without just taking some huge risk, driving without thinking.
Yeah, most of the time not, because right. If something unusual happens to us, then we usually, if another car swipes a little close or there's something unusual on the road, we come to attention and start making decisions immediately. So we're not completely separated from our actions, but we're only monitoring them in a very general way. So we're not really paying attention in the same way as when we are making decisions. Your other example was getting sucked into media and how we all sort of get just engrossed in what we're doing. And that, I think, is very much a function of the way electronics are formulated, produced, presented to us in ways that really capture our attention and leave us feeling like we don't have much volitional control. And that's a different thing. That has to do with the way the electronics themselves are configured. And I've been looking at your website and reading portions of your book, and I think it's very interesting what you're doing, which is you're sort of reverse engineering an awful lot of what has happened in the computing world and our phone electronics world. You're sort of reverse engineering it to give people back a sense of control, which is really interesting to read.
Yeah.
It's a cool approach.
Well, and the reason I reached out to you initially was that I had read a story in the New Yorker, which was largely based on, you know, sort of a review of your book. And the author used the word friction, which then I realized that you use a ton in your book. And in fact, there was one part in your book where I think you said, if people only take one thing away, I want them to take away the idea of friction. And that was an amazing moment for me, because that's exactly how we talk about it too. We sort of explain that designers and engineers and product managers have spent years trying to make apps and devices that are as friction-free as possible. And the secret, if you will, I mean, to the extent that there is a secret, the secret to regaining control is to add some of that friction back in.
Exactly. And that's also the secret to changing unwanted habits we have that aren't working for us. And part of the reason why I think we all need to be educated about friction is what you said at the beginning of this podcast, that we tend to overestimate the impact of our own personal experience, you know, our thoughts, our feelings. That's what we know. And we tend to view those as very important. which they are for our happiness, but the environments that we're in, the context that we're in, the way electronics have been engineered and configured also is extremely important and has impact that we don't normally think about because we're so focused on our own internal experience. And this was something that was an insight of an early psychologist, Kurt Lewin, when he argued that just like there are physical forces in the world, like gravity and friction, mm-hmm. there are also forces in our psychological worlds. There are drivers and resisting forces in the environments that we're in, and resisting forces is just another word for friction. So there are things that promote action and things that impede action, make it more difficult. And yes, one way to control habits is to impede their performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about what's going on in our brains when we're in one of those time-sucking phone sessions or other media sessions, because it's not just our phones. You know, it can certainly happen when we're binge-watching Netflix or whatever. But what's actually going on? Why does it feel like time is just disappearing? Because as you pointed out, it's not the same as driving, where we let this automatic routine take over, thus freeing up our minds. It's almost more like our minds are fully occupied. And so I'm wondering if you could talk more about what's really going on when we feel like time is just disappearing.
I think I have more to say about why we find those electronics so very habit forming.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And that is that they were designed specifically to tap into a few features of our minds that perpetuate their use, that keep us using them. And one thing that you guys have pointed out is that they provide rewards only on an intermittent basis.
Yeah.
So habits are really, rewards are really important for forming habits. But some kinds of rewards work better than others. And our brains are really responsive to intermittent or occasional rewards, the kind we get from email mm-hmm. or from notifications on our phones. Those activate a dopamine response in our brain that then ties together what we are doing in what context that got that reward. And it's just the same kind of response we get when we are sitting in front of a slot machine in a casino. We see these bright lights flashing. Every once in a while, we get close to winning something and we stick with it because even less often, we actually win something. And then that winning just keeps us putting money into the slot machine over and over again because of the way our brains are wired to respond to intermittent rewards with this dopamine response. And that's really important for habit formation. Mm. For one reason, and that is habits represent a sort of a shortcut, a mental shortcut. They tie together what we're doing, as I said, in what context that got a certain reward, so that when we're in the context again in the future, that response automatically comes to mind. And that makes sense because it's our brain's best guess as to what to do to get that reward again. And so habits become this sort of mental shortcut. Hear a ping on your phone, respond to it. And you do it whether you want to take the time out or not. And I think that's one of the challenging feelings that our electronics gives us, is we almost feel like we are no longer in control. Another example goes back to this idea of friction, that electronics have made our decision to use them almost frictionless. I mean, that was the whole idea behind Uber, right? To set up a car hire service where you just pushed a button and a car showed up almost by magic, which is wonderful if you need to take a ride somewhere.
Yeah.
But the same principles are used to keep us watching Netflix or any other video streaming program. They just move on to the next show without you even having to make a decision. It's just one button press right at the beginning of the whole experience, and then it continues on until you finally fall asleep. I mean, I don't know what happens. It goes forever until you actually intervene and make a decision. This has to stop. I have to go to bed. My kids, I need to read a story to them. It's actually, that's, I think, the feeling that we get when, that's what happens when we feel like we're out of control, like the electronics are controlling us, because it's so easy to just sit there and have that continued experience, and it takes effort to get out of it, which is why we end up feeling somewhat controlled.
Right. Yeah, one thing that Jake and I often, and Jake's my co-author and my friend, one thing we often talk about with folks is how to think of our technology products as tools and think of all the amazing things that they can do for us, like allowing us to get a car or allowing us to download a book in 10 seconds or step off an airplane in a strange city and be able to know our way around. But try to focus on those types of uses, using our technology as tools instead of letting our technology use us. Just sounds like is what you're talking about here.
Yes, exactly. That all of these things have good uses. They make our lives easier, more fun, more interesting, more accessible, but they were also designed to get us to overuse them. And that's where the challenge comes in.
Yeah. So there are so many interesting things I want to ask you about. And they're not all about phones, but I just have one more question that's about kind of, you know, devices and technology use. I was really intrigued by how you described frugal decisions. So creating a habit of making frugal decisions. So about purchasing things. You said
saving money or not spending it. Yes.
Yeah. You said part of the reward of making a frugal decision was that you are rewarded with a feeling of, or you're rewarded with pride and a feeling of success at having made that decision. And I wonder, is there something similar in the world of technology use? I mean, is it possible for us to cultivate a mindset by which we actually feel rewarded because we didn't look at our phone, or because we didn't check Instagram this morning, or because we didn't look at our email after work? I wonder if that's something that is possible or something that you've thought of.
Yeah, I think it is hard to feel proud of not doing something. So, because it's sort of the absence of activity makes me feel proud. That's sure. Hard to maintain. I think keeping a focus on saving money or using your time wisely or valuing the people you're with over the technology, those are ways of framing the decisions that you're talking about that make it a positive choice, something you can feel proud about. So when you talk about habits, and this comes from research on habits, it's very hard for people to have a habit of not doing something. Instead, we're doing something else. So you might not eat healthfully, instead, but it's not an absence of a healthful eating habit. Instead, what you're doing is you're probably snacking a lot on junk food. And that's sure, a more useful way to conceptualize the habit because it describes what you're doing. And it's easier to form a habit to do something than just to not respond.
I see. Yeah. So it's like you said in your essay at the end of the book about how to spend less time on your phone, it's creating a new habit that replaces, you know, instead of checking your phone, it's reading a book, or perhaps it's spending time with your family or with somebody you care about. So it's thinking about the new thing that you're doing instead of the old thing, rather than focusing on what you're not doing.
Yeah, because if you focus on what you're not doing, then you're back into the dilemma that I started the book with, which is we know that self-denial and inhibition can work in the short run, but ultimately it's actually sort of counterproductive. So if you are deciding, I'm not going to respond to my phone, what you're doing is you're inhibiting that response. And that becomes then something that it's hard not to think about, right? So then you start thinking, okay, so I didn't respond to that. I wonder who that was. I wonder if that was something that was actually something I would want to hear. Maybe it was my kids. Maybe it was somebody else. Maybe it's my boss. So you start sort of thinking too much about the thing that you are denying yourself. And that by itself becomes counterproductive and trips us up ultimately. It's the way the mind works. It traces back to a classic study that was done about white bears. This made it somewhat into the popular literature, so some of your audience may have heard of this, where a researcher told people not to think about white bears. Sounds ridiculous. None of us do think about white bears, so why would that be a problem? But if you tell people not to, even not to think about something that ridiculous, then once they can think about it, it's like it takes on a life of its own. It energizes itself so that you can't stop thinking about it. That simple act of inhibition turns us into someone who's obsessed with whatever it is we're trying not to think about or respond to.
Yeah. Yeah, that is super interesting and very helpful and reinforces some of the advice that we give people, which is to not be simply defensive about their time and focus on avoiding distraction, but to also be proactive and think about what you want to be making time for, what you actually do want to be focused on.
Exactly. That's just the advice I would give people.
Yeah.
And that works not just with electronics, that works with so many of the behaviors that we're trying to control. If you go on a diet thinking about all the things that you're not going to eat anymore, it's going to become very hard to maintain that. Or if you start putting yourself on a budget and end up thinking about all the things you're not buying that all your friends were able to buy, new technology that has emerged since you made this decision to go on a budget, then you're going to be quite unhappy and feel deprived.
Yeah. How does the idea of mindset fit into your work in all of this stuff, if at all? I didn't see much mention of it in your book, and I'm curious if that was intentional or if it's just not kind of part of your purview.
It isn't. Both are true. It is intentional because mindset is part of our conscious thinking self, and there have been so many books written about that already. So much analysis of planning, thinking, different types of mindsets, different types of orientations. All of that is very helpful in thinking about the conscious mind, the self we know.
Okay. Yeah.
But our habit self is really just a function of, it learns from repetition, reward in a stable context. And those are the three components. Your mindset, in a way, is irrelevant. It can influence what you find as rewarding.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
But the reward itself is what creates the habit, not the mindset. So that's something that I tried to stress in the book, is that we learn habits by doing. So you actually have to get on your phone and get a few messages before you figure out how to use it and start developing a habit to use it. Your decision to use it or not is not the habit. The habit is what your brain learns over time, and it only learns this slowly with repeated experience as you get rewards in your daily environment, in your daily context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask you about is how habit formation and sort of, you know, deliberate, to the extent that people will, you know, after reading your book, hopefully they will be more thoughtful and more deliberate about trying to change their habits. How does that fit with goals that people have? If somebody has some long-term goal to, you know, achieve something in a year or in 3 years or whatever, how should they be thinking about their habits, and how can they deliberately form or change their habits to help them reach that goal, however far in the future it might be?
That's a great question. Habits are a part of our brain, well, they involve a part of our brain that is relatively separate from goals, our desire to pursue goals, and the decisions we make. So the fact that we have these different neural systems, one that we commonly call habit, the other that we commonly call decision making, arises because our brains are, they're not a unified whole. They're not just a single thing. Instead, they developed over time, they evolved over time to have multiple components and multiple parts that can function somewhat separately, but are also interconnected. And what we have learned in research from watching people is that those who are really good at meeting their goals, and let me say, many of the goals that you and me and other people are pursuing require repeated actions over time, so that it's not enough to just make a decision and do something once. You're not going to be able to save for retirement that way. You're not going to have great health outcomes that way. Your electronics are still going to be disrupting the rest of your life, even if you controlled them once. All of these things are, all of these goals that we have require repeated action. And studies that have observed how people do this, how do people in the real world achieve success, have found that they do so by forming habits so that they can do it automatically. They're not making a decision each time they go to the gym, or making a decision each time they put a paycheck, part of their paycheck, aside for retirement. Mm-hmm. We can automate this. Some of the automation comes from electronics. So you can have your bank automatically set up withdrawals. And so you don't even have to see the money. So electronics can help with this automation.
Yeah.
But much of it is also actual just repetition for us that makes the behavior much easier.
Yeah, I suppose that's especially true with something like going to the gym, where you can't automate going to the gym. You know, your bank account or your electronics can't do that for you, but your habits can certainly help you.
Yeah, although many apps seem to promise that they can.
Right.
So many of the exercise apps.
Yeah, I know. Remember those gimmicky things that would like straps that would go around your body and they would like machines that would move you? They would like...
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Those jiggly things, yes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was, and this was kind of as far as I got in the book, unfortunately, but it was about this idea of discontinuity, about how certain types of changes to our life, you know, moving or starting a new job, can be opportunities to create new habits or, you know, change old habits. And I wondered if it was possible to engineer this kind of discontinuity. You know, if we're not moving, we're not starting a new job, we don't have any big life changes happening, can we almost create them for ourselves so that we have this wonderful opportunity to change our habits?
Yes, that's actually one of the central pieces of advice in the book. Our habit memories don't fade very quickly. In fact, there are some researchers who believe that they never fade, that we always have memories of the habits that we've learned hanging around ready to reappear in the right context. And this really presents challenges for changing habits, because if you keep in the same context, you're going to have the same unwanted behavior come to mind and have to inhibit it actively each time and make a decision not to do that thing that you did so often in the past, whether it's spending money or sitting on the couch instead of going to the gym or whatever the thing is that is unwanted in your life, whatever your bad habits are. So trying to control habits is really not part, it's really, you can't use decisions. You can't use decision making. You can't use willpower, because that memory is always going to be there. And it will last longer, usually, than any decision we make. So one way that research has shown that we can control habits is to change the cues in our environment. And as you said, these cues change naturally when we move, when we start new relationships, start new jobs. We're all of a sudden exposed to new environments, new structures, new people that give us new opportunities. Our old habits aren't in the way to constrain our choices. But we can also use that logic in organizing the cues around us to activate the habits that we want. So if you are trying to change your eating habits, it's very hard to do that without changing the environment in which you eat. If you're going to continue to snack at night on the sofa while watching TV and continue to have Fritos and donuts and other things on your kitchen counter, then your old habits will be cued regardless of your best intentions. What research has shown is if we put food, other temptations away, we reorganize our lives so we're not sitting on the couch. Maybe you take a walk in the evening. Maybe you meet your neighbor so that you have some accountability in taking a walk in the evening. There's great research on controlling cues, and proximity is a big piece of that because it's a piece of friction.
right? You want to have cues close to you for behaviors you want to engage in and the things that you don't want to do further away. There's a study where people have a bowl of popcorn, buttered popcorn, right in front of them, and a bowl of apple slices right behind it, so they have to reach to get the apple slices. Or the reverse, apple slices right in front of them, and the bowl of buttered popcorn at arm's length. And what the research showed is that people eat three times as many calories if the popcorn is right in front of them. And that doesn't make sense, right? Because we can reach both bowls regardless of where they're placed. But that simple distance is enough to make it difficult for us to actually access the popcorn in quite the same way in those two situations. Yeah. And we're very susceptible, very responsive to that sort of proximity. And that's what disruption does, is it alters the cues in our environment and it changes the behaviors then that are activated by those cues. And we have a chance to make decisions and to change old habits when contexts shift.
I was going to say, it sounds like there's nothing magical about these big discontinuities like moving, but rather they provide a sort of convenient opportunity to shift all of the context cues. Is that right?
Exactly. Unfortunately, there are also times when we often feel overwhelmed and like we can't make any changes, but we have to make those, we have to make new decisions in new contexts because we don't have old patterns there to fall back on.
Yeah.
So that's an opportunity. It's a sort of a window of opportunity for us to make new choices, form new habits.
Yeah. And if somebody feels overwhelmed and they feel like they can't change things, but they don't have one of these natural discontinuities, what do you suggest? Is it just about finding the small ways that they can begin to change their context?
Yeah. The most fun I had in writing this book was I got to go up to the Culinary Institute of America and hang out with their chefs for a while when they just started training. And what chefs do is they have to learn to control and construct a context in their kitchen where it's easy to make a particular recipe. And chefs call this mise en place, which is putting everything in place. They do all the chopping, they get all the ingredients together, they measure everything out, and they order it in the order they're going to use in the recipe. Now, chefs don't automatically do this, right? Like the rest of us, trying to change our behavior. They jump in and they try to start doing things initially, but they have to learn that organizing their context, although it might seem like it slows them down, in fact, is the most efficient way to make the same recipe at the same high quality level each time. And that's a good metaphor for people wanting to change their behavior. It takes some initial planning to change our context and to figure out, okay, so what would make it easier for me to save money? What would make it easier for me to eat healthfully or go to the gym? And organize our environments to do those things. But that actually has payoff down the line because it keeps you doing whatever the behavior is, even after you're no longer thinking about whether you want to.
Yeah.
And my example in the book was warning systems in cars. I bought a new car a number of years ago, and they have all these beeping sensors every time you get close to an object. And it's very irritating if you're not used to it. But over time, you just don't even hear it anymore. And the first time I rented a car after buying this new car, it didn't have the warning system, and I backed into a brick wall because I no longer noticed the warning system, right? That had been set up for me to keep me safe, and I was responding to it, but I didn't notice it, and I didn't notice it when it wasn't there either. So it wasn't there to protect me, and I had an accident. And that's the way our environments, if they're structured in beneficial ways, can help us, is they keep us repeating the actions that are working for us, that are in our best interest,
right,
when we're not thinking about them and we're not making a decision.
Yeah, when I read that story in the book, I actually laughed out loud about you backing into the brick wall, which I'm sure wasn't very funny for you at the time that it happened, but it was just such a vivid example. I really love that one. Well, I think that's a good place to start, or to stop rather. Thank you so much, Wendy. I am certain that we'll be able to get a lot of really interesting stuff out of this, this chat. So thank you.
Well, it was lovely talking to you, and it was great learning about the work that you're doing, which I think is fascinating.
Hey everybody. Thanks again for listening. And thanks to Wendy for her willingness to chat with me and to share her expertise. There is a text transcript of this interview available at the Make Time website. So if you go to maketime.blog/articles, you will find it there. And if you want to read more about Wendy Wood's fascinating work on habits, you can check out her book, Good Habits, Bad Habits, or you can go to her website, goodhabitsbadhabits.org. Thanks.